Welcome. I returned a couple of days ago from a month-long retreat, just sitting on my own in the mountains down south of Big Sur in the Los Padres National Forest, where Tassajara Monastery abides. So the mountains looked familiar. It was about 6 miles in from the coast. The road was much more rough than the Tassajara road. Had to take like a kind of, what do they call this? Off-road. Like a buggy kind of thing. I'd drive through rivers and things like that. And then this place was, there were, once you get way in there, there's only, I think there were maybe two or three other people. And one was like kind of a retreat caretaker who would make the long journey into town every 2 weeks to get food for the other people upon request. I brought enough for my month that I didn't need to request any. And then a few of these little cabins that are spread far enough apart that you can't see or hear anybody else. People go there and do meditation retreats. It's called Land of Calm Abiding. It's a very conducive place for calm abiding. They have 1 month minimum, so I just squeezed in. And I think another person was there coming around the same time as me for a couple months, but the long-termer up above me has been there 15 years. The current, interesting, I thought, talking with the caretaker on the way out, who's been there about a year, said, "Have you ever met him?" Or he said, "No, I've never seen him." So I think they've been through many caretakers over the years, but they've never met this practitioner. So I've kind of gotten into the habit of doing these month-long retreats. I think this is the fourth year in a row now. And I guess it's kind of captured my heart, this kind of practice. But this one was more, some of them I've done with Shoho before. We'll do some talking or there's cabins close enough by that you might see somebody walk by, but this is the first time where, in my life really, not seeing another human being for a month, not seeing or hearing, no internet, no cell phone, no contact, no idea what's going on in the world. And when I think of 15 years, I think a month is very short, but, you know, it becomes kind of timeless expanse. Just keeping a kind of a sesshin schedule, sitting 9 or 10 hours of meditation a day, and being in the wilderness with the mist and rain and the sun and the snakes and the deer and the rats, and the ants who took over this, the bathroom of this place. So, it might sound like a kind of a strange thing to do if you have some free time. There might be more interesting things to do than that, right? So one might ask, why would one do such a thing? And when I heard about this 15-year guy, I might wonder why, but I think I have more of a sense now than I have in the past. Really, we could ask, why does anybody ever do anything? And I would propose, you can check it out and see for yourself, but it seems to me that everything we do, like all day long, from scratching our ear to speaking this word to having lunch to going for a walk to Zazen, is that we're looking for peace and happiness. Some might say, I think a lot of things I do are for that reason, but contemplating this, I kind of feel like everything, 24/7. We can put aside the discussion of dreams because they don't seem so intentional, but at least waking life, everything that we're doing with any intention, which is basically everything except our heart beating and our breath flowing, I would say we're doing it to find kind of this equilibrium of peace and contentment. Even if we say, no, I'm actually sacrificing my own happiness to benefit others. We could debate this point, but I would still say, we've just learned, very nice thing to have learned, that we're actually more happy benefiting others. But still the same reason, just we've kind of refined the activity. So I think that's a great contemplation just to take up through the day ourselves. Especially if we're doing something we might complain about, like, I really don't want to be doing this, to kind of remember this thought and be like, actually, I'm choosing to do this. And even though it's painful, I don't really like it, I'm actually doing it because, strangely, I think it will bring more happiness. It gets a little complex, right? Because I'm giving up something, you know, I might be in a job that I don't really like, for example, but I really feel like the happiness from earning that income makes it worth doing a job I don't really like. Be an example. I really think there's no other random reasons we do things. And usually, we choose to do things to find this happiness or contentment. We look for the happiness and contentment in things outside ourself. Do we not? Maybe in, you know, material things or possessions. We all, even if we're not totally involved in it all the time, all these things we know very well. We look for, you know, wealth or savings or possessions. Or that might be a kind of obvious one, but also in relationships, the people outside ourselves, and like substances or states of mind. That might be kind of like, well, a state of mind really outside myself, but I would still call it an objective experience. It's an experience. Another way we could say it is we're looking for happiness and contentment in experiences, which is something that is impermanent and arises and ceases in time and space, including relationships and states of mind and activities, wholesome, good activities, but going for a walk in the woods. But if we're looking for the, because this activity brings me happiness, it's still kind of the same principle. It's something other than, seems to be other than ourself in the moment. And we go about this in all different ways, right? Some of us do it in really confused ways that just, we're looking for happiness, but we bring so much suffering upon ourselves. We know this. And some of us, you know, by watching cause and effect, we learn a little bit about certain things that seem like they might work, maybe don't really work. Life is a process of learning, kind of refining our search for happiness. Sometimes we talk about sentient beings, Buddhas and sentient beings. I think that one way we could define a sentient being is this search or this quest or this looking for happiness. It's not even like that's one of the qualities of a sentient being. I think from a Dharma perspective, it's interesting to try on the definition of, that's the definition of a sentient being, is the search, the looking for happiness in some experience, objective experience. Sentient beings are generally considered a somewhat or either a lot or a little deluded. Like, because basically it kind of works, you know, right? It kind of works. That's why we keep doing it. I keep doing it too. I look for happiness in objective experiences. And it kind of works. We get some happiness sometimes. As if we refine how we do it, it kind of works. But all of it, if it's any objective experience, like a walk in beautiful woods or something, it's temporary, right? It's impermanent. And I think many people might feel like, well, of course, it's all impermanent. There's no other way than that. But this is where these spiritual traditions come in. Sometimes we might feel like if we're really into this happiness thing, we're really almost like obsessed with contentment. You might say like supremely selfish to be that kind of person, to not settle for halfway. Then we might feel like we might start to slowly notice that everything that we're doing to bring happiness is impermanent and therefore not ultimately permanently satisfying. And we start to become disillusioned. I like that word. Disillusioned by our looking for contentment in any experience. Our illusion that that will work is, at least that will work in terms of lasting, sustainable contentment. And this disillusionment is a wonderful thing, because when the Dharma fire starts to smolder and cook, become disillusioned with any activity. And then then anything that's, you know, external to ourself, the objective world outside of ourself. So then we think, well, is there anything other than that? And that's when we might start turning the other way, towards ourself, thinking, well, it's not anywhere out there. Maybe it's in here? Not exactly in here like a place, but just not out there. We can say when we start to get even curious about something that's not out there, we could say that's when the search for happiness shifts from looking for it in external objects to looking for it not in external objects or activities or experiences. And then we could call it the search for enlightenment or spiritual awakening. Maybe that sounds kind of heavy duty. You might feel like, well, I've been into practice for a while, but I don't feel like I'm searching for enlightenment. So maybe, if that's too heavy a word, we just look, we're looking for happiness not in an external event. For example, we come to Zazen. But then, as we start to practice Zazen, we start to notice maybe this is just a more refined version of the same thing, because is it like a state of mind that we're looking for in Zazen, like a relaxed, calm state, an experience, a temporary experience during Zazen of calmness and serenity that maybe even extends outside of Zazen into our day somewhat. But it's not like we sit Zazen once and we're content forever and ever, right? But it kind of, I think we're going in the right direction. These are like major discoveries, right? This, and I think everyone in this room has made this major discovery. That's why you're in this room. To whatever extent you have, you're like, I see there's some value in sitting still and not looking for some particular special experience somewhere else outside myself, where I have to bring something in. But as I say, we can get into a more subtle way of looking for happiness in experiences or activities like Zazen or retreats. So the more we notice this and examine these tendencies, and we hear the Dharma, and we hear the Buddha's teaching that the Buddha was also into this, right? He's, you know, kind of shows the way of, he was looking for happiness in external events, and then he got really into different meditation practices, and he was looking for it there too. But he kept being dissatisfied. He was like the best meditator in India, right? Learned all these meditation states and experiences, deeper and deeper levels of temporary experience. But again, he was like the, you know, this great example of not going to settle for anything less than unconditioned happiness. Conditioned happiness means it comes from a conditioned experience, which means a temporary experience. Of course, the Buddha uses these temporary meditation experiences to kind of like approach or sort of go, start aiming in the right direction. But we hear about the unconditioned, and sometimes we think it just gets too weird when we start hearing about that. It doesn't make any sense, because everything is conditioned, isn't it? Sometimes the Buddha would even say, everything is impermanent and conditioned and dissatisfying. But then we hear, he realized something that wasn't impermanent and wasn't conditioned and wasn't dissatisfying. But mainly, he doesn't talk about that so much, because he doesn't want us to grasp it as another experience. He just wants, I think, especially the early Buddha's teachings, really wanted to get us disillusioned with everything. I recently came across this quote from the Indian Buddhist sage Saraha. I think he lived in the 8th century. And the saying is, devotion, this is kind of a definition of devotion. Devotion is trusting cause and effect. Kind of a strange saying, isn't it? Huh? But this one's really been percolating for me in the last weeks. I love this saying. I think it's very profound. You want to know what devotion is? Devotion, you could say, to practice or to anything. Devotion to, you know, getting enough sleep. Whatever, right? whatever we're devoted to, it's what we, it's the, based on the trust in cause and effect. In other words, we start noticing patterns of activity. When this activity happens, this effect happens. And if it's a good effect, means like leads to happiness and contentment, then we start noticing the correlation. This, this, you know, cause leads to this happy effect, and then we become devoted to, because we're always devoted to happiness. We can't escape that one. Then we start becoming devoted to various different causes of happiness. And sometimes it's, again, like a horror story, right? That's how addiction can start, right? It's like, this cause leads to, like, big happiness here, even though it comes with a lot of bad stuff, you know, painful stuff too, and it's very temporary. It's good enough that I start to become devoted to this cause. So it can be, I can think it can apply to anything, but practice, like when I think of that fellow who's up on that mountain for 15 years, and I say, how would somebody ever do that? How could they be that devoted to just sitting there for that long with no contact with the world? Isn't that like insanity and the definition of total misery and isolation and deprivation? We have to assume that his devotion to what he's doing is based on trusting cause and effect. It's just outside of our particular experience. Does that make sense? That's a nice one to contemplate too. Devotion is trusting cause and effect. So if we wonder what we're devoted to, we can actually see what we're doing. Because that's what we're doing, again, 24/7, is based on our understanding of cause and effect. And sometimes people might say, I'm really devoted to Zazen, but I really don't have time to do it much. I would say, according to this way of thinking, and I would say, it's not really that we're devoted to Zazen. I would say more, it's like, we're not devoted to where our heart is. This might sound kind of strange. We're devoted to where our body is. Like what we're actually doing is what we're really devoted to. When the rubber hits the road. Of course, being devoted in our heart, to have an aspiration in our heart in a certain direction, creates the actual devotion to doing what we want. But it's really what we're doing with this life is what we're devoted to. I might say, well, I don't really have a choice. Everybody has a choice. We are totally free within certain circumstances. And in order to have some things, we have to give up some things. And we might be more devoted to the things that we don't want to give up, which is reasonable. But then we can admit that what we're really devoted to. Now again, I myself am devoted to looking for happiness in many external experiences and activities. And to the extent that I am devoted in that, I feel like in some ways, when I feel most clear, I feel like I'm kind of like not in accord with my deepest intention at those times. It's okay. I don't want to be too heavy-handed about it. But just notice. Also, with practice, I think a nice way to, this is another contemplation, yeah, that strikes me these days, is if we're become disillusioned from looking for contentment in activities and experiences and relationships and things, then and we start looking towards that which is not an experience, then we can have some understanding of what that means, because the Buddhas and ancestors have made these discoveries and their teachings are still alive in this world. It's like we're so fortunate that that is the case, right? And so we can hear the Dharma and we can understand it. So in the way I would use, this is kind of one formulation of looking at these different types of accord with reality, we might say. Understanding would be like comes in concepts. It comes in hearing the Dharma. And it changes us. If we really contemplate Dharma and stay with it and work it and reflect on it, our understanding starts to change. Our conceptual understanding, which can get, you know, quite profound degrees of conceptual understanding, can happen. But then they say understanding, this kind of intellectual or conceptual understandings, like a patch, like that you sew on a patch or you put a plaster patch on the wall, and it's kind of stuck there temporarily, but eventually it will fall off. That's the problem with understanding. Conceptual understanding is a temporary event, and it might be really clear at some time, like I really get what these teachings are saying, but then the next day I might be like, I thought I got it, but what was that again? The patch fell off. So then applying what we understand in our own meditation and life, we can have a direct experience of the teachings. So experience in this case is like not a conceptual understanding. It's a direct taste of a conceptual understanding. But in this model, it's said that experience is like the mist. It's beautifully hangs there for a little while, but then the sun comes out and it just evaporates and fades. Because again, experience is temporary. It's an experience that happens in time and space. So it's, in a way, it's deeper because it's a confirmation of something that, some Dharma that we heard, a direct confirmation, but it's just a temporary experience. So then, if we, again, continue to practice with this confirmation, this verification of direct experience, extend it, let it pervade more and more activities, let it pervade not only throughout longer within the meditation period, but even outside the meditation, then eventually we can come to, we could say, realization, which is said to be like space, which doesn't evaporate like the mist and doesn't fall off like a patch. So, they work together. For experience, I think, maybe in Zen we sometimes downplay the conceptual understanding part, and maybe experiences spontaneously happen, but I think they're kind of unreliable. That's why the Dharma continues to be conveyed and kept alive in this world, because it has something to do with the actual direct experience. And then direct experience has something to do with realization, which would be like continuity. And now we're starting to talk about something that's not one of those impermanent experiences. But this is a challenge. But it's good to keep in mind the possibilities. On the wall of this retreat cabin where I was staying, some previous retreat, and had posted a quote from the Dalai Lama, and that was, I found encouraging. It's kind of long, but the part that I remember was something like, in these times, the world's great spiritual traditions have greatly degenerated. Buddhism even has its teachings of like the ages of decline and so on. And in such times, then the practitioners of these great traditions need to make a specially strong effort for this realization for the benefit of all beings. If we allow the lineages of transmission to disappear in this world, then this world will be plunged into darkness. To me, this was good medicine for retreat. And also, I want to leave some time to talk, but just as a practical teaching, one that really helps me in a retreat like this and helps me in everyday life, as it were, for already practitioners and have a practice, these contemplations that kind of like turn the mind and cause and or kind of examining cause and effect. In this retreat, I would do it 4 times every day at least, and really try to take them to heart. And I try to do every day for years now. These contemplations to take to heart are remembering the precious, rare gift of this human life. So amazing and so easy to take for granted and not remember what a precious, amazing gift it is. Like, can't just say the words, but feel like that this is really, it's almost a little bit of turning back to even get into the feeling of it. This is amazing. We can look out of these eyes. We can hear with these ears. We can meet each other. We live in this beautiful, mysterious realm of this universe. It's incredibly awesome. We don't even know what it is. I mean, I don't know what it is, but it's awesome and it's rare. We know it's we know it's special because we know it's limited. So that's the next contemplation: is it's going to end. Impermanence. This precious, rare, mysterious gift of this life is going to end, and we don't know when. It could be today. For many people that think it'll happen someday, for many people, it's today. I don't know how many millions of people died today, but millions, right? We know it's going to come, we don't know when, and in that perspective, you could say, in our last minute, you could say, how do we want to have lived our life? So this is the rarity and precious opportunity of human life. And I would even add in, not just human life, but like, we're like these people who found this practice. Now, really, like, major opportunity. This is like, the precious thing just got magnified like a million times for those who have even heard about some kind of practice of, we can find a kind of freedom and true contentment. Can find the unconditioned peace. This is like major rare. So sometimes they say it's like we don't want to return from a jewel island empty-handed. So this rare opportunity. Opportunity is a good word. Of human life, of a zazen period, of the day, of this moment. This moment is this rare opportunity. And then it's quickly passing. It's going to be over in a flash. Just these two alone are really good, powerful motivation for me to practice. And the other two, just briefly, are contemplating cause and effect that we kind of already talked about. Everything we do has an effect. Everything we do has an effect. And just watch that carefully. And then the fourth is just kind of like noticing this kind of disillusionment with any kind of grasping, any kind of experience or activity or any object is ultimately dissatisfying. So the first one's really nice, right? Such a great opportunity, it's so sweet. So that really gets us kind of energized, and maybe the next three are kind of sobering. Like, oh, but it's almost gone, and everything I do makes a difference. Any kind of grasping, which the more we practice, the more we see it's basically continuous grasping, is dissatisfying. And there is an alternative. I think if we really take these four to heart, we don't need any other motivation to practice. So, anything you'd like to bring up or ask about? Yes. So this month there was a familiar thing that happened the last time I did this last year at the same pattern, so I've made note of it for future retreats, which was I'm the kind of guy that kind of functions well on a kind of structure. So I mean, I think any retreat it's good to set up a schedule, but it's a pretty strict schedule from the get-go. And so so the first week was hard. I think I remember saying this the last time I came out of retreat. The first week was hard. Like, maybe it's too much, but I kind of like, maybe my own pride or whatever, I don't want to lessen the schedule. So let's just keep going. It was hard, but I got to learn about myself. It was physical and mental. Not so much like leg pain and stuff, but energetic. Like some traditions talk about like wind imbalances from kind of trying, from too much effort. So I think that's partly what's happening. I think I got kind of sick and... So I found that like resting on breaks, really, really relaxing on breaks, and you know, walking meditation, and kind of spaciousness kind of helped. But I think what I would note for the future is and I've heard this from other long-term retreat people, that start less strict and work up gradually to more strict. As opposed to the other way around, I gradually get some more slack. And I think it's good advice, especially for maybe even longer than a month. So, but after the first week, or around there, then it got much easier. It got very nice with the same schedule. It kind of settled into an energetic groove. But like other things were like, I never felt lonely. I think because there was so much, you know, practice focus. I got a lot of strong intention of focus. There wasn't that much time to think about that there was nobody around. but sometimes I would contemplate. And I definitely had thoughts like, if you didn't have like a really well-established practice and knew what you were doing in meditation, you could go a little bit crazy, I think. We're just not seeing any, with no human contact. And something about the regularity of like, every day, like almost exactly the same, makes it kind of dreamlike, right? Because you just start losing track. I actually had like a iPad that has the calendar on it, and like if I didn't have that electronic thing and I just had a paper calendar, and I think I could easily lose track of what day, which wouldn't be so good because then they'd come to pick you up at the end and you wouldn't be ready, you wouldn't be packed. So it's like kind of check. Oh, okay, yeah. And so it has a cycle, like a month has a cycle, like the midpoint has a, just like a sesshin. The middle day of sesshin has a certain feeling. It's like we made a long way and we can see we made it this much, but there's still a lot more, like 2 weeks. And and then the end, of course, has a bittersweet feeling of like, I really don't want to leave, and I really do want to leave. Like it's time. Yes?
I'm curious about a couple of things. First, are you going to keep your retreat here?
Probably not. There's some tradition of, just letting everything go.
Yeah.
I didn't even take a shower for a month. There was nobody around.
Yeah. So, how do you do it by yourself?
Like,
do you have any pointers for doing a service by yourself?
Yeah, just the way we regularly do it, but I didn't actually even have a bell, or just the chanting part. Sometimes I've had a bell, and a makugyo.
Oh, right.
You can bring a small makugyo and a bell this time. I just chanting and bowing to the ancestors and well-being ceremonies, full moon ceremonies I would do, recite the precepts, and I would chant for this Sangha. I have a list of all of your names and everybody else, and I would try to, it's a long list, but sometimes I would try to really do it so slowly enough to bring each person to mind and kind of like, sometimes in Tibetan tradition, we sometimes say like, you can mingle your mind with your teacher. And I think this principle is there in early Chan Zen, Dharma transmission, like Huang Bo talks about the transmission of mind very much in this way. And it's not so much that like, you don't mix your thoughts, you're not reading another's mind, but you realize that the essence, the nature of your mind is exactly the same. And when you realize that, it's not like you're really mixing them, but you have the same mind. And you all have the same mind. So sometimes I try to be like, we're actually meeting in this deepest possible realm where we can, our minds are in a way mingled all the time actually, but we can like bring that, to mind. It's like, so intimate, way more intimate than we're having a conversation in person without mingling minds across thousands of miles, right? It's the other person maybe doesn't know you're doing that, but it's like, so, and then Yeah, lots of ritual stuff. I love that. And in a way, I think that's also part of the psychology. If it was like a kind of no toys style, if I were to do just zazen with just silent zazen and nothing else, I don't think that would work so well for me. Because these practices, these devotional practices, liturgical practices, are relational. Maybe that's why it wasn't loneliness, because you're relating to all these Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and ancestors that are actually present right now in this deepest way. And with our mingled minds, we're meeting and we know this is what the kind of thing they were doing, and it's the kind of thing that they are right now, dead or alive. So, yeah, I think, yes.
Do you have any participation with any of the beings of the place, the animals or the elements or the plants? Do they participate or contribute in any way?
Yeah, so... such a beautiful place. Again, very much like Thassar, there was a creek going through a valley with these kind of steep mountains with the same vegetation, but the cabins were higher, which is nice. You had a bigger view. Yeah, a lot of wildlife. So, like deer would come in very close to me, you know, just because it's so peaceful, right? And just very curious and just eye gazing with the deer, and after the food offerings that I would make to the Buddhas, then I would bring them outside, and so I started making relationships with those blue jays and squirrels that would partake of these offerings, and now of course I would always make prayers. This is kind of like, you know, the flower ornament sutras, all into all these bodhisattva wishes, that you can make every activity into like a wish. So like whatever sentient beings, animals, but even invisible sentient beings, anyone who partakes of this food offering may be completely happy and have the causes of true lasting happiness and free from all suffering and actually, if you start squawking at each other, open to like your loving connection between each other and open to the vastness that you're in right now and realize the great awakened way. Trying to do that with every animal food offering, right? And even like trying to make like everything into offerings, like my pee and poop. They say, sometimes say hungry ghosts actually love pee and poop. So I don't know if there are such beings, but this is happening, and why just make it a poop? Like, May any hungry ghosts who enjoy poop, may you fully receive this offering and be totally delighted. And sincerely feel it. I mean, really try to do that. But the other creatures, I think the main relationship was these ants. These ants, they come in at night. And they kind of take over the floor, and I could, you know, in the bathroom, and I could see a little hole there coming through, and I found some, you know, putty, and like, I can stop that. Devotion is trusting cause and effect. So I don't know what those ants are so devoted to that they're the effects that they're getting from coming into that cabin, but they were determined. So I block one place, they come another, I block that place, they come another, and a dustpan with a soft brush, I could kind of collect a bunch of them and take them out over and over until I realized this is just fruitless. The main reason I would take them out is because I didn't want to step on them. I didn't want to hurt them. It's like I also didn't really want them crawling on me. But I, you know, I'd turn on the light in the morning to go to the bathroom, and there'd be a few on the floor kind of asleep or something, but the light would wake them up. And after a while I discovered that the bathroom light would draw them all into the bathroom. So I'm trying to brush my teeth, and they're like, I have to leave the room so I don't step on them. And it was, you know, incredibly frustrating. It really like would sometimes really disturb my serenity. So they were great bodhisattvas.
Did you thank them for strengthening your practice?
Yeah. And eventually I learned to live with them, and I noticed these patterns of, like, the more I just let them be and don't even try to take them out, the less interested they are in, like, coming in force like that. Which makes, you know, things like that, many things like that, make me wonder about this world. About the cause and effect of this world and how mind works. I see the rats in the attic, so, like, trying to sleep, you know, and they're, like, scratching. And, like, let's mingle mind with them. Let's really, like, bring them into the space of total spaciousness. Then they get quiet. It's like, I don't know how these things work. But, many animals were teachers for me. And plants and lizards. I would sit outside and have lunch, and on this tree stump, this family of lizards, I really got to know how they seem to operate and how they relate to me. And yeah, the non-human world is beautiful. When there's no humans around, you notice it a lot more. It's true. So I'm very grateful to have had that time, and an aspiration arises to do it again. And I feel all of your support to be able to do such things. Support from so many beings, right? It takes a lot. The people who take care of that secret gem of that place. They have a little website, but people don't know about it. 1 month minimum has made it a little tough. So that's some thoughts for the evening. And if you're into retreat, we're going to start another one tomorrow, a group retreat at Jikoji Zen Center, Compassionate Radiant Light Temple up in the Santa Cruz Mountains. And we're going to study Dogen and sit a lot of Zazen. Dogen's teaching of mind cannot be grasped. You're all welcome to come for any part of it. Come and go anytime. May the merit of our gathering and all open-heartedness that arises from wholesome practice throughout the world be gathered together and offered throughout space and time to all beings everywhere. May they all be happy, free from suffering, and realize the great awakened way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become a